I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Michael Weber. Michael Weber is a motion picture producer, director, who spent much of his earlier career producing scripted theatrical films released by studios such as 20th Century Fox and Lionsgate. In 2010, Weber departed from the world of fiction films to pursue his passion project, a groundbreaking cinema verite documentary about the underground exotic pet trade in the U.S. titled The Elephant in the Living Room. The film would go on to win 5 Best Documentary Awards, earning its place among the top-rated films of the year and releasing as the #1 independent film in the U.S. Weber was awarded the coveted Genesis Award from the Humane Society of the United States for his contribution to animal welfare in his motion picture work. He has been a featured guest on countless television and radio talk shows, including appearances on The Today Show, ABC World News Tonight, NBC Nightly News, and Nightline. His work was also the subject of an ABC 2020 special. His most recent documentary is a continuation of his investigative work into exotic animal trafficking in the U.S., but from an angle that nobody saw coming. Titled The Conservation Game, Weber's new film blows the lid off America's most beloved television conservationists, exposing their secret connection to the exotic animal trade and their decades-long ruse on the American public. The film started off its world premiere with a bang, winning a social justice award, and has movie critics drawing comparisons to Blackfish. According to Variety, the film has recently scored a raft of international film sales and is just now releasing in the U.S. after a limited theatrical run. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
So for people who have not yet seen The Conservation Game, which I've seen it and it's excellent, for people who haven't seen it, can you just introduce them to the documentary? What's it really about?
Yeah, so this movie takes a deep dive into this unseen world of our most trusted television celebrity conservationists, for lack of a better term. You know, people that we see on morning shows and late shows bringing and toting these animals out there, you know, and giving a conservation message about the animal and in general. But it goes deep into this secret connection that I think that they have with the exotic animal trade. And so the story of the film really follows the story of a retired police officer in Ohio who, while he and I were actually filming undercover at an exotic animal auction, and we should get into what that means here soon. But basically, we come to suspect that these endangered animals that we see on television shows with our most beloved animal conservationists are not actually part of a legitimate zoo or sanctuary program. They may actually be involved in the trafficking and the exploitation of these exotic animals. And that's really the flashpoint and the beginning of the film, which actually leads into a 3 to 4 year investigation into this topic.
So let's back up a second. And the film begins with the person, and I'm terrible with names, I'm sorry, the protagonist. What's his name?
Sure. Tim Harrison is the police officer in Ohio.
Yeah. Okay. It begins with Tim Harrison watching Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. And I remember, I was really moved by that because I remember watching that too. And I always had a very mixed feeling when I watched it, because on one hand, I loved seeing the wild animals. And on another hand, even when I was 6 and 7 and 8, I didn't yet know the word exploitative, and I didn't yet know the word set up. And I didn't, but it seemed to me that I didn't like it. It felt, I both loved it for seeing the wild animals and hated it for, to use a 7-year-old language word, it felt yucky. And can you go on from there?
Well, I think that your experience is actually shared by a lot of other people out there as well. You know, most of what we hear is the affinity that we had for those, for the people on those shows, and also for the shows themselves. And I'll admit, it did probably for you and for me and for my kids, it did draw about some interest. And with the protagonist in the film, it drew about some interest in wildlife and nature. And so, you know, this is a universal experience among various generations. So from you and me, where there's Wild Kingdom, and I really grew up with Jack Hanna. And then my kids grew up, you know, on Animal Planet with people like Jared Miller, and then here comes people like Boone Smith and Dave Salmoni. And so there's such a popular, you know, genre that, you know, all generations have experienced this. You just kind of plug in the different name of who you grew up with. But, you know, but the question is, what did it actually cause us to do? Did it cause us to become interested in these animals? Absolutely, yes. Did it make us want to go outside and look for crickets and dig through creeks to look for frogs and snakes and so forth? That seems to be a universal experience as well. And I think that that is of benefit, you know. But we also see that these shows also, I think, have led to the exploitation of animals by the public as we're watching, as these shows evolved from what I think, you know, Wild Kingdom was pretty interesting and everything. But we saw this really evolve with Jack Hanna and through the years with cable television, where, you know, it didn't just, you didn't just kind of suspect there was some exploitation going on. It's full-throated exploitation on television. And what we see is, you know, the interest that it generated in you or me when we were growing up, that interest turned into people at home wanting to buy a tiger and stick it in their backyard, or wanting to buy an alligator and put it in their basement or in their bathtub. I mean, so this really took a deep, dark turn just a couple decades ago as this became more popular. And you think about people like Steve Irwin and so forth, Crocodile Hunter, you know, as this evolved and well, progressed, for lack of a better term.
Well, here's something I've never admitted in public, but it's true that when I was, you know, 6 or 7 or however old I was, there was one of those wildlife programs was about a caracal. It's a type of cat. And I remember that I got this wild hare and I spent the afternoon calling all the pet stores to see if I could get one. And I, you know, it's horrifying, but at the same time, I'm just saying there was that impulse in me, you know, even though now I would be horrified by that impulse.
Well, that has happened with everybody. And if you look at the big cat crisis that we have in the United States, or if we look at the exotic animal crisis that we've had in the United States, it's because of what you experienced right there. And we touch on that in the film, this monkey see, monkey do mentality, where obviously when you see that on television, you're going to want to do the same thing that your heroes on TV are doing. And though these shows that we watched never said, leave it alone. They never said, let's just, you know, peer from a distance and let's not disturb the animal or anything. What these shows do, especially eventually, is it's man versus nature. Let's go jump on its back. Let's wrestle it. Let's capture it and so forth. And so, you know, what that does is it makes the rest of us want to do that same thing. Or let's take a tiger cub and let's cuddle it. Let's bring it on morning shows and late shows, you know, under the guise of a conservation message. Well, we're going to want to do the same thing. And the public actually does that. They say, well, I want to do that. Sure, they told me this, it makes a terrible pet. Sure, they said that, you know, this was a rescue and only I'm allowed to do that. But the fact of the matter is, in the United States, there is the ability, and it's legal, and in many states, it's been this way for a long time, to actually go purchase these animals that you see on morning and late shows. And so people did that, you know, and so, you know, at exotic animal auctions or just at, in a, you know, Trading Post classified ad. And so we've seen that, what you experienced, we've seen that actually happen ad nauseum in the United States, to the point that it's become a huge crisis. And so what they didn't do was say, why don't we just leave the animal alone? Or they didn't say, I'm not going to bring an animal on because that gives the wrong message. Instead, they did the thing that supposedly they're telling you not to do. And then we end up with the crisis that we have in the U.S. right now.
So I have like 4 possible directions to go from there. But actually, I want to go a different direction for just a moment first, which is to say that my favorite wild animal videos that I've ever seen and I've seen a few of these the last few years, are the ones where somebody puts up a camera on a game trail or next to a log or next to a little pond, and then they just walk away and they come back a year later and, you know, you see bears walk by, you see beavers walk by, and yes, they had to put the camera there, but it's nobody gets captured, nobody gets hauled onto Jimmy Kimmel, none of the wild animals are doing anything but living their lives. And I love those videos. Anyway, I just wanted to say that and just contrast that with, you know, jumping on the back of an alligator.
Yeah, I mean, we're told actually, you know, when you have conversations with people in the animal industry, you know, we're told that we can't do what you just described there. After I did my first film, The Elephant in the Living Room, you know, the Tim Harrison and I actually, the movie, you know, was such a big hit that really everyone wanted to do a TV series that was basically a spinoff of that show. And we had many conversations that are kind of like what you have, which is Tim Harrison wanted to move this toward a better place where we could leave animals alone. We can leave them in the wild. We can observe them and teach people sort of a better way on television instead of what's going on. And that's an impossible thing to pitch in the entertainment industry. That falls on deaf ears. Everyone will tell you, of course, no one will watch that. And I'm not saying that that's not true either, but no one will watch that. Look at the popularity of Steve Irwin. Look at the popularity of Dave Salmoni and Boone Smith and Jack Hanna. Their popularity doesn't exist by being calm and not touching the animal and not wrestling with it. Their popularity is the further you can take the excitement of wrestling and touching and apprehending that animal, you know, the bigger you will be. Steve Irwin is a perfect example. So I'm not saying that the networks and what they're saying that people want isn't true, but I like to believe that we could move people, even if by necessity, from what I've done with the conservation game, if it starts to move the networks to a place of to what you mentioned, and then by virtue of that, maybe an audience will come along with them and actually enjoy, as you do, as I would, as I think other people would, the idea of not wrestling and exploiting the animals on TV. You know, I think we should give it a shot. But when you look at the conservation game and some of the effects that it has had already, even in its limited release here in the U.S., is pretty remarkable. And I'm curious to see what direction we will go now as a result of the film.
Okay, so I have like five questions. I'm going to throw them all at you, and then you can just choose which, if any, you want to answer. One of them is, what is the meta message that is really being taught when you have a lion cub or a giant vulture or an albino alligator on a TV talk show, frankly, in between some actor pitching his new movie and somebody else pitching a weight loss plan or something? So first off, what is the actual meta message that's being taught about nature? Or you mentioned the conservation game, and in fact, you titled the film that. So what is the conservation game that you are going after? Or you've mentioned a crisis of the animal trade several times. Or you've talked about the exotic animal auctions. Or, oh wait, I forgot my most important one. Or what happens to these cute little tiger cubs after they're on Jimmy Kimmel?
Well, I think all of these are such important questions that I will hit them all in rapid fire, you know, for us. But because I mean, these are really good questions. I think the meta message when we see a celebrity conservationist, you know, bring a cub onto, you know, a morning or late show, I think there are two conflicting messages. One is the verbal message. I'm here. We're supposed to learn about this animal and respect it. And if you love this animal, you know, that translates into your love for the animal in the wild. And by the way, these make terrible pets, you know, make no mistake. This is a terrible pet, but I'm allowed to do this because I have to do this in order for you to become interested in the animal. And by the way, this animal will be taken care of for the rest of its life. It's part of a conservation program. It's going to go back to a zoo from where it came. And so that's sort of that's exactly the verbal message on television. The reality is that most of those things are untrue. That animal, in all likelihood, as is exposed in the film, did not come from any accredited zoo. It may have come from a private breeder or someone's backyard or a roadside zoo. That animal will not go to an accredited zoo or any kind of conservation program. We're told by Jack Hanna, for instance, many, many times, he'll tell us it's part of the SSP, the, you know, esteemed species survival plan with the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. Many times that's a bold-faced lie, as you see in the film. He's just telling you that so that you feel good about the fact that he has an endangered species on his lap on television. And the fact of the matter is that animal will go into the exploitation trade where it will be used for birthday parties and weddings and many times eventually vanish into that trade, never to be seen or found again. And then it'll just do it over and over again. And so from a messaging standpoint, the message that we received, and this is demonstrative in the United States, the true message received is this is a pet. This is a pet. And why do I say that's demonstrative? We actually don't know how many captive tigers we have in the United States. Some of the estimates are maybe 5,000. When I did Elephant in the Living Room, it was well known that there are more tigers in captivity in Texas than there were in the wild in India. So how does that happen? Well, that happens because our celebrities go on TV with these animals and treat them like pets. You see in the film where they literally bring cubs out in baskets, just like it's a puppy. And so message received, this is a pet. And meanwhile, and this transitions into your crisis question, there's a big cat crisis in the United States where we have countless cougars, lions, tigers in private hands all over the United States to the tune of thousands that are discarded, that are in people's backyards and in their basements and so forth. And this has led to, which I won't get into yet, but this has led to some serious animal welfare issues, and it's led to some serious public safety issues. As far as the con and conservation, you know, the way that I see it, and I've come to realize it over the past 12, 13, 14 years being deep into this industry, is, you know, what we see on television with the people that I've mentioned is really sort of a classic confidence game. You know, a lot of people don't realize that a con game is really derived from the term a confidence game. And a classic confidence game is like a shell game. And so you gain the confidence of your target. And once you have their confidence and they trust you and they believe you, that's when you've got them. And that's when you can hook them. And I believe that that's what's happening on these late shows with these so-called conservationists, is what happens is they gain or they earn your trust over time. And so at that point, they can actually tell you anything. This is part of the SSP. This animal was a rescue. It's going to go to a 10,000 acre animal reserve and live out the rest of its life as if it's, you know, in the wild. And you're never going to check to see if that's true. Why would you not check? Well, because Jack Hanna told me, and he has gained my confidence over the years, and I trust him. And the fact of the matter is the things that I just mentioned are exactly what Jack Hanna says. And those things are actually untrue. And that is demonstrated beyond any shadow of a doubt in the film time and again. And so this really feels like, to me, sort of a classic confidence game that's been pulled on the public. And that's why I, you know, kind of use the term conservation game as a play on words there.
So we still have a couple of those questions, but before we go to those, I want to say another part of the meta message on these that really horrifies me, and that's it's a message of human supremacy, because we can bring it out and we can hold up this big scary alligator, but look, I'm in control, I'm carrying it. And also, when I wrote my anti-zoo book in 2004 or whenever it was, one of the things I came to is one of the real lessons of zoos is that you can remove a wolverine from habitat and still have a wolverine. And you can put it in a concrete cage and it's still a wolverine, as opposed to a wolverine being all of the relationships between the scents in the air, the forest itself, the snow on the ground. And so there's this mechanical notion that just like, if you can take a spark plug out of a car and it's still a spark plug, and then you put it back in and it's all fine. But if you take a bear out of the forest, I mean, is it still a bear? And so it, for me, has... And I didn't, that was one of my problems with zoos, apart from the fact that they're all in prison. That was one of my problems with zoos when I was a kid, where I would go to the zoo getting all excited, but I would feel so sad when I left. And it feels the same with all these shows too. It's that, you have this animal who was just minding its own business, and now it's being hauled. I mean, here's the thing I'm trying to get at, and then I'll shut up, that how would we feel if space aliens came down and they, grabbed us, and then they put us on this, their equivalent of the Tonight Show, and they're all laughing at us? We would be horrified. If this was a movie from a human perspective with aliens doing it to us, it would be a horror movie.
Exactly. I mean, you nailed on two really real aspects of it that are close to me, and I'm so glad you brought those up. But the one that just permeates through all of these interactions that we see on television is that macho mentality. Many times you'll see Dave Salmoni is a great example of him on the shows, the cable shows that he will do, is him loving and huggling and wrestling, with these big cats and tigers. And his shirt is off all the time. These guys work out a lot and they love to show off their body. You know, this macho mentality of them dominating these apex predators and so forth is just throughout. You look at the same thing with Steve Irwin, for instance, and then rolling around with and tackling these dangerous animals. And so that's a horrible message. In many cases, these animals are actually not wild. They were raised by humans. When they're dealing with crocodiles and snakes, they had been cooled down in coolers. I know the people who work behind the scenes, and they tell me all of the tricks, but it has to be man dominating on nature rather than living with it. And to be honest, we celebrate that for some odd reason. People celebrate it, and we turn heroes out of these people that are pouncing on the backs of these animals. And to be perfectly honest, to dovetail into what you're saying is, and they're disrespecting them. Their interactions are the ultimate disrespect of that majestic creature that actually deserves the respect and the acknowledgement of what it is. And we're not treating it for what it is. And I think that that's what you're talking about too. When we see it on these shows or in captivity, when I did my previous film, it followed the story of a man who was raising African lions in the country, just in his backyard. And the question is, that's not an African lion, that's just some kind of prop that's being used, and it's no different than our celebrity conservationist. It's just a prop for some sort of entertainment purpose, trying to tell me that I have to do this to make you interested in the lion in Africa or the tiger in India. And what I say, and I think a lot of people would say this too, if they just can kind of change their mindset a little bit, is you having that tiger cub in a basket on a late show does nothing to show me what that, to respect what that animal is in the wild. And am I so dense that you have to do that and exploit the animal so that, and we can coo at it like it's a baby or like it's a kitty cat or a dog in order for me to love the animal in Africa. That has no semblance of anything of that lion in Africa. It has no semblance of it whatsoever. And so I think your point is very well taken. We fall into these patterns and these routines where we do this and we are then celebrated for doing this activity and we make a ton of money doing it. We literally build empires and we build networks and shows and everything on the backs of these animals because we're celebrated for this behavior. And it's not going to stop until that house of cards comes down. For as long as people pay their money, as long as you get the ratings, as long as you build bigger facilities and people come and celebrate it, well, it will continue. And I hope and believe that with the conservation game, with what I've been able to expose in this film, that that house of cards will come down. And I have evidence to show that it has already fallen.
So that would be a really good avenue to explore, but I want to go back to a couple of the earlier questions first. One of them is, so what happens to the cute little tiger cub after it's on television or for the alligator for that matter? What happens to them? Not 10 yeah. minutes after, but 10 weeks after, or what happens when the cub is no longer this cute little thing?
Yeah. Well, you bring up two interesting, species there, because I can talk specifically to both of them. One, with the big cats like a lion or tiger cub, but even the alligator, I have an interesting personal experience with that. So we are not told the truth. The reason we're not told the truth is because these conservationists know that if they tell us the truth, we will be horrified by this and that they would never be allowed on television ever again. So to me, there's a knowledge, obviously, by the conservationists themselves that what they're doing is wrong. And that's evidenced by the fact that they have to lie to you because if they told you the truth, they wouldn't be able to continue with this activity.
Which you get, you get the actual promoters of this saying that explicitly. There's one of exactly. them says something to the effect of, there's no upside to me telling you the truth. I couldn't believe he actually was that honest with you.
Well, that's something that we should get into too, which is the person was being honest, but they didn't know they were being recorded. And so it was important for me, I thought, with the film. I mean, look, we can sit on the show now and I can make these assertions and I can explain to people how it works. And that's true. And it's true, but it doesn't help the person who's listening because I'll need to be able to demonstrate it. And, claims like this are pretty serious. And so you're going to have to go pretty far in order to show it beyond any, I think not beyond a reasonable doubt, beyond a shadow of a doubt with something like this. And so in the film, I believe that I do that, which allows me to be able to make these claims. And one thing that was important is eventually regarding to where are these animals, eventually you're going to have to go to the people who last had them. And those are the celebrities that I, am asserting are involved in this trafficking of them. And so you have to do that, but it needs to be done in such a way that you might be able to get some honesty out of them. And also they're not prepared for it, because otherwise you're going to get all the same BS answers and everything that you do anywhere else. And that's why with every one of them, I made sure that we had interactions with them where they didn't know that they were being recorded, because I didn't want to hear what I've heard on TV. I can turn on the TV any night and listen to that. What I want to hear is, what would they say when they don't think they're being recorded? What would they say when someone comes up to them and asks them, how would they react? So a perfect example would be if someone's kids are missing, and I think that something, that the dad maybe had something to do with it. That very first interaction when police officer knocks on the door is going to tell you a lot. If you say, hey, your kids are missing, will they be shocked by it? Will they be defensive? in law enforcement, a lot of times you call them spontaneous utterances. What will they actually just say when they're taken off guard? And we see that with every one of them in this film. And it's hugely revealing, just like you mentioned, where they will say things like, what's the upside in the public knowing the truth? The biggest thing that I think is revealing is that not one of them were surprised. You know, you saw us put a list in front of the people saying your ambassador animals on TV are missing. We can't locate a single one of them. And none of these conservationists batted an eye. They just said, yep. Okay. One of them said, well, I'm not going to tell you where they are, but you're just not looking hard enough. No, one of them tried to push the list away so they'd have some kind of plausible deniability that he never received the list. And not one of them was able to say where these animals were when on TV they were just saying they were going to AZA zoos. And not one of them followed up with an answer, and none of them were surprised. But every one of them puckered up. I know that they had called each other and said, you know, don't talk to Tim Harrison and so forth. That was very, very revealing. They all knew what was going on. They've all been in on it. It's a pattern in the industry. This is not an anomaly. This is the system. This is how it works. And it's systemic. And those recordings and those interactions were critical.
So thank you for that. And so what does happen to the animals after?
Well, unfortunately, there's a thing in the industry where what people wouldn't imagine is, let's say you take a tiger cub onto a television show. Well, it's cute and cuddly, and it's fun to drop in the lap of the host of the show or the actor, you know, that happens to be on the show promoting their film at that time. And we all get a lot of laughs out of it. But imagine how many times you've seen that with an alligator, with a big cat is what we focus on in the film. Well, you've seen that hundreds of times, and every network has their own morning show person who does this and their own late show person who does this. And then all of those guys have their own cable shows. So that's a lot of animals being brought onto TV. So let's just think about the big cats. Well, when's the last time you went to a zoo and you saw a bunch of empty cages? Where are all these big cats going to go? We're talking dozens, maybe hundreds, maybe more. I mean, countless over the years when you think about all the shows and all the animals they bring on. Most of the time, they bring on multiple ones so they can all climb all over themselves and everything, because that becomes pretty funny, I guess. So there's literally nowhere for them to go in any kind of conservation program or any AZA zoo, for instance. There's no place for them. Where are you going to store hundreds of these big cats? They also go from a commodity to a liability. So that cub, while you can take it on to shows and pass it around and get some good laughs and interactions from people, actually you can exploit it. You could take it to birthday parties. You can have it participate in interactions at weddings and so forth, a lot of the cubs that we see in the film later do, that people don't realize. Well, once it becomes too big to cuddle, then it becomes a mouth to feed. That animal, properly cared for, will cost hundreds of thousands, probably millions of dollars to properly care for it with veterinary care and food and a proper habitat and everything for the rest of its life. And it's not like you can put them all together into one place. You're not going to put snow leopards with tigers, or even maybe two tigers together with lions. So it becomes a very expensive liability. So what you have to do if you're going to be involved in this activity, which we see so much, is you're going to have to get rid of the byproduct, that byproduct being, unfortunately, that endangered species that you had on that show, because you can't exploit it anymore. It's just going to sit there and pace in a cage or a habitat for the rest of its life. So a lot of people have really never thought about that. I never thought about it. You probably didn't either when you've seen them on these shows. And so they've had to come up with a way for this to just go away. And the way that this has worked, and I believe I first saw this happening with Jack Hanna. So some of what I'm about to tell you is what I call the house that Jack built. Because what we saw is Jack Hanna began working with these non-AZA accredited facilities. So here he is, the director of the Columbus Zoo, the director emeritus of the Columbus Zoo, and they're building an empire there. But what are you going to do with all these animals? Well, an AZA zoo, is not going to allow you to take their snow leopards around or tigers or whatever, because it's not good for that animal. You got to find someone else to do that. And that's where they get to the backyard breeders. That's where they get them from the auctions. That's where they get them from these roadside zoos. And then they have to make it go away. And so these, you know, private breeders and exploiters that use them and all these other activities later essentially say, look, just give it back to me and I'll just essentially make it go away. And they'll continue to exploit it and do other kind of shows or what have you. That's kind of off the radar, even in illegal activities, as you've seen in the film. And for many of them, we don't know. We literally, it's impossible to find out where they go. I mean, your imagination runs wild. They're dead. Were they euthanized? Were they killed? Were they used in canned hunts? What happened to them? And no one will ever be able to know. That's why they don't microchip them. That's why they don't keep records of them. So they're telling the public this, you know, one thing, but they've got to make that animal go away, and they do.
So another topic, thank you for that. Another topic that we were going to hit that we haven't yet is, and just to sort of time check in, we have probably 15 minutes left, 13 minutes left, somewhere in there. So we're like two thirds of the way through. Anyway, you haven't really talked about exotic animal auctions.
Yeah, the auctions are, if people can imagine, it's a sort of a classic auction. But where these exotic animal auctions occur is the ones that I went undercover at were like in Amish country in the middle of rural Ohio, for instance. And they take place in different places, rural areas around the country. And what they will do on certain times of the year is do the exotic animals, and they'll bring in hyenas. People will bring in tigers and lions. They'll bring in baboons, you know, primates, cougar cubs, and they will sell them out to the general public, to the highest bidder. And there's a lot of cash changing hands. The public doesn't need a license. There's no licensing requirement. You can take it and just drive it across state lines. They just take them home and put them in their backyard or their basement. And you just see animal after animal after animal just being carted out again and again and again, while there are literally grandstands of people sitting there eating, you know, nachos and cheese and hot dogs. And you have an auctioneer just bringing the next animal out, holding it up. It might be a baboon, bringing the next one out. It's a cougar cub. Bring the next one out. It's a tiger cub. Then people take them home as pets. I mean, it's literally otherworldly. And it is like something that no one's ever seen. They don't allow cameras in there. It is open to the public, but they don't allow cameras. If they find you with cameras, they will kick you out and threaten you and so forth. So I went undercover about 12, 13, 14 years ago at one of these auctions. And that's actually was really shocking to see. But what I didn't anticipate seeing is I remember looking over to my right, and you end up seeing this in the film, and I see a conservationist that my kids grew up with, and his name is Jared Miller. He had an Animal Planet show. He's on Rachel Ray. He's on Conan O'Brien, everything. And I look to my right, and there he is standing there in person. Remember, I have a hidden camera on, and he's standing there in the middle of the auction. And we followed him throughout the auction, literally buying and selling animals, presumably to go on television and then to dump the other animals that he just had on shows. Now, that was shocking to me. And so you see that happen with the police officers that I was with also in the film. And again, with, you know, one of Jack Hanna's right-hand people who was there as well. And so that begs for an explanation as to what's going on here. Why are these people here? You know, and is it possible that they're actually involved in the exotic exploitation trade? I knew at the time that this was Pandora's box. I went ahead and finished the film I was working at the time called The Elephant in the Living Room, and I shelved that material. I knew that it would require its own investigation, you know, arguably its own film. And later I did pull that off the shelf. I kind of thought that the issue would solve itself. I thought that this would kind of go the way of the dodo, that with the elephant in the living room and other things that had happened around the country, that we would start to see this wane and that we would see this exploitation kind of go away. But in fact, it grew and it grew. They became more and more brazen. And I knew that we had to do something. And that's when we started the investigation of that's in the conservation game, knowing what we might be able to find. But the further we went, the deeper it got, the bigger it was with this big systemic problem within animal entertainment, that it was shocking what we actually found and that you end up seeing in the film.
You mentioned earlier that you had a personal story about an alligator used on TV shows.
Yeah, this has never made it into any of my films. But after that auction, we also went to this part is in my previous film. We went to Hamburg, Pennsylvania, where they have a reptile expo. And at this expo, they sell venomous snakes out to the general public, you know, puff adders, gaboon vipers. They sell alligators and crocodiles inside of these little Dixie cups for people to give to their kids. Now, this is in the heyday of Steve Irwin and Crocodile Hunter. So anything you see on TV, suddenly it's going to show up in the exotic market and everyone's going to want them. So you can imagine with Steve Irwin, the countless thousands or hundreds of thousands of millions of alligators and crocodiles just in these little cups that are just little babies in there that they sell out to the public, all of which to be eventually flushed down toilets or to die in the people's bathtubs or in their basements or to be dropped into a local creek where then it would just freeze over and die. You know, so this is what happens at that reptile auction. Well, when we went there, Tim Harrison and I, we're saying, look, what I'd like to see is if there's a Nile crocodile. Now that's pretty rare. They're selling alligators, you know, by the hundreds, but I'd like to see a Nile crocodile. That would be interesting. And we saw someone selling a Nile crocodile there. And I'm recording this again, and we look up to see this Nile crocodile being sold to the public. And the person who's selling it is Jared Miller, the same person that we saw at the previous auction, same person that my kids grew up watching on TV. Ironically, they were probably at that time watching him on TV while I was at that expo. And that just goes to show you know, what's really happening within this industry. I believe that was the same Nile crocodile that he had on the Rachel Ray show and countless other shows. And of course, he doesn't have a zoo for that to go back to or anything. And it cost him some money to get it. So he was selling it for a substantial price out to the public. I was going to buy that crocodile then from him to get it off the market. And we went back to the car. And by the time I came back, he had left with the crocodile and asked the person who was right there, who was with him, like, what happened? And he said, well, he changed his mind. He suddenly decided he didn't want to sell it. I think he knew that I think he started to suspect what was going on and didn't want any part of it and then just vanished. As you say, this doesn't just happen with big cats like we see in the conservation game. This would happen with, you know, all manner of exotic animals in this big cat, you know, I'm sorry, in this exotic animal trade in the U.S.
You know, I one of the things that somebody wrote in wrote in a review of one of my books that I really liked is that they said that in my analysis, I can be almost pathologically unsentimental. And that's not unemotional. Had they said I was pathologically unemotional, I would have cried, which is a joke. But but I think what they were getting at is I'm really clear headed and I don't let I don't let sentimentality get in the way of my analysis. And I'm very proud of that. But having said that, the thing that gets me about all of these TV shows and about zoos. So I opened my zoo book with a bear. It's a grizzly bear who is in a cage, who is walking four steps one direction, dipping her head, turning to the left, walking four steps, dipping her head, turning to the left, walking four steps, dipping her head, turning to the left, walking four steps, dipping her head, and repeating this endlessly. She's clearly been driven insane. And I said, this isn't sentimental, though. This is just appalling that every one of those animals we're talking about is in fact a living being with dignity and with, it's not a damn prop. That's what I'm trying to say. And I just get so, this is one reason, or even when they do it out in the wild, you know, you have some, I don't know, Gila monster just minding its own business. And all of a sudden some jerk has to go up and poke it until it bites. And I don't know. I wouldn't like it if space aliens came toward me and started poking me until I bit them. And with this other stuff too. And the reason I brought up all this stuff about the sentimentality is that I know that the larger issues are habitat loss, you know, destruction of the biosphere. You say in the film that there are more tigers captive in the United States than there are in wild. And those are the real issues. But, you know, and when I wrote the zoo book, they capture animals wild for zoos. And like one example they gave is there were a bunch of monkeys who found a bunch of fermented fruit, and the fermented fruit had been left out there specifically by people who capture animals for zoos. So all the monkeys ate the fermented fruit. They fell asleep drunk, and then they woke up in cages on their way to Berlin and Cincinnati. And it just, I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with this. It's just, this just, I can't tell you how appalled your film made me. Not because, not at the film, but at the subject.
Yeah, I think I'm with you 100%, obviously. And I will tell you something encouraging, though. I think what happens with the general public, I mean, the fact of the matter is they're not familiar with the issues. They don't know what's going on behind the scenes. If they did know what was going on behind the scenes, they would be appalled just like yourself, and they wouldn't be celebrating and praising these people. That's something that's good to know. But what they need is the information. And the problem that we have is that because, you know, they've been so monetized in terms of these animals, and they've been turned into entertainment under the guise of conservation and so forth, where you don't know where conservation ends and entertainment begins, and there's so much money involved and these empires have been built, is that none of that messaging, none of the true messaging ever makes it to the public, because just as you explained, it's all entertainment. It is all entertainment, make no mistake. But the public doesn't know that. And here's what's great. When you look at the conservation game, the day after the conservation game first premiered at the Santa Barbara International Film Festival, and the press and other people were able to see it, the following day, Jack Hanna stepped away from public life, presumably forever. And his family, you know, tweeted on Twitter that he's suffering from dementia that escalated faster than they thought it would, and so forth. Now, the one thing that's sort of tragic about that, aside from the dementia diagnosis, is that I looked forward to the day that this film would finally come out after 4 years of working on this, where the public and the press could confront Jack and get the answers that I couldn't get and say, what's going on with these animals? Where do they go? What's happening? And what's so disheartening to me is that those questions for him will never be answered, and those secrets will vanish along with him. But what's encouraging about it is as soon as that happened, in the coming days or weeks, the Columbus Zoo did an about face on the Big Cat Public Safety Act, which is a bill in front of Congress, which would be a federal bill that would stop the private ownership of these animals. And then what we've seen since is the people that I just talked about that we see that are exposed in the film, they have not appeared on television with an animal or period since the film has started to roll out. very few people have still seen this film. We're only just now releasing in the US. That's encouraging. And we also haven't seen on any morning shows or late shows since the film started rolling out. We haven't seen anybody on there with an animal at all. And so I think what's happening is that when we know the truth, if someone's able to find the truth, distill it, and then reveal it to the public, we can see things change. The question is, are there people out there who are willing to dig deep enough to find the truth? And then can those people then bring that to the public? Because I think the public generally, at least we give them a chance to be receptive to the idea of the truth and what's really happening. And I think that's where we at least potentially can see change. But without that, you'll see nothing. You'll see no change whatsoever. And I'd like to think that in my tiny little corner of this part of this world, that I'm one of those people that has been able to do that in this case, and that has effectuated change again in this very small little corner that I'm able to work in.
Well, thank you for all that. And that would be a wonderful note to end on. And we don't have much time, but I do want to ask you two more things real quick. One of them is tell everybody the name of the film again and how they can see it.
It is The Conservation Game. And since we're rolling out in the US right now, the best thing to do is just to go to theconservationgame.com, and it will show you, depending on when you discover the podcast here, it will show you, you know, where you can see it, and it will be readily available to you immediately.
And then the last thing is something that we said before we started the official interview that I was hoping we would put in somewhere, and we haven't, and this might be a good thing to end on, is one of the comments I made before we started was that if you want to see, I think we have an innate need to see and to be in some sort of experience with wild animals. And what I've always thought is if you want to interact with wild animals, you should act, instead of forcing them onto a television program, you should act such that a wild animal wants to interact with you. And so can you just respond to that and then go wherever you want for the finale?
Well, I think you're 100% right. Over time, over hundreds or thousands of years, somehow, and our society has come about, like the fact that we even have the word nature versus us. We talk about nature, and somehow we're separated from that. How is it that, you know, here we are as humans, right? And then there's nature, and so. So we see it that way, that out there, what we see and we experience, let's talk about the animal, that's nature, right? But I'm a human, and these are two different things. And so it's kind of built into our mentality. And I think there are a lot of things that you know, stem from that are negative, and the least of which is what you mentioned there, where we don't really have that connection with it. And I don't think that was not always the case. I think that is a somewhat modern concept. And that's just the way that we see ourselves. That's the way that we act. And that's also the way that we treat this thing that we call nature, which is different from us. And I think there's a problem with that. You know, we, as you mentioned earlier, I don't know why that snow leopard doesn't deserve just as much, you know, respect and care and everything that you or I would. And I don't know why we would be treating nature differently than us. You know, I think you've nailed it. I think you get it. I think people can come along with that. I will tell you one really quick anecdote. When I did the elephant in the living room, I went around to some zoos, and I remember you were mentioning seeing a bear pace back and forth. I can remember at that time seeing an elephant just neurologically, just leaning and going back and forth. And the people were kind of laughing, and kids were laughing, acting like it was dancing. Well, of course, you know that animal wasn't dancing. That animal was at its wit's end neurologically from having been caged up. Let's fast forward 10 years later when I'm shooting the conservation game. I went to a zoo again to look for these animals that obviously weren't there. And what I heard from people was very different than 10 years prior. I heard people looking at the animals and saying things like, well, that's sad, or I don't want to see that. Like, these are people who paid to go to the zoo, and yet they were not really pleased with what they were seeing. This wasn't like it was what I had seen before. It seems like they had become a little bit educated as to what's going on. They weren't exactly thrilled with what they're seeing. And this was at one of the best zoos in the country. So that, again, gives me a little bit of hope that with education, and we can slowly get there. And like what I'm doing and what you're doing is to let the give the public a different way of thinking that they haven't been given before. And I think they'll be receptive to it, because like you and me, they have a heart too. They just haven't been receiving the message. They've been receiving this bogus message by these celebrity conservationists who are just entertainers in a costume on TV. If we can get this new message out to them, and if I can force that to happen by way of my film, then I think we can slowly work toward a better place. I just don't know if we can get there fast enough.
Well, thank you so much for all that, and thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Michael Weber. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.